Welcome to the Free to Choose Media Podcast. Today's podcast is the discussion portion of The Power of the Market, part of Volume 1 of the 10-part public television series Free to Choose. Milton Friedman is joined by other distinguished guests in the Harper Library at the University of Chicago to discuss some of the ideas presented in the documentary segment of The Power of the Market, last week's podcast. Listen now, and don't forget to subscribe and get updates each week for the Free to Choose Media Podcast.
And here at the Harper Library in the University of Chicago, our distinguished guests have their own ideas, too. So let's join them now.
It seemed to me he was saying that the golden age for America, when it was truly a land of opportunity, was the late 19th, early 20th century. No regulations, no permits, no red tape.
I would argue that the government played a decisive role in an enormous grant to the railroads in creating an American capitalist economy. And secondly, if you go back to that golden age, you find that the government constantly intervened in a rather characteristic way. It used troops against strikers. American labor history has been the most violent, bloody class struggle anywhere in the world. And the government, up until 1932, the law, the courts, the society, always sided with business, always sided against working people. Therefore, I would argue that both economically and in terms of repressing the attempts of people to assert their freedom, a government prior to the rise of the welfare state in this country was more or less owned by business.
Milton Friedman.
Michael Harrington is seeing the hole in the barn door, and he's not looking at the barn door itself. The plain fact is, during the whole of that period, while government did intervene from time to time, and mostly to do harm, I agree with him that government intervention was, in the main, not a good thing, tariffs, for example. On the other hand, throughout that whole period, government spending, federal government spending, central government spending, never was more than 3% of the national income. It was trivial. The land grants to the railroads were a minor factor. I don't approve of them. I'm not saying they were a good thing, but they were a very minor factor. One has to have a sense of proportion, and that goes to the whole discussion. I am not an anarchist. I am not in favor of eliminating government. I believe we need a government. But we need a government that sets a framework and rules within which individuals pursuing their own objectives can work together and cooperate together. And they work together and cooperate together not only in economic areas.
Well, I want to hold you for a moment, though, to that golden age theory that we were best when we were regulated least in the late 19th and early 20th century. Because remember, the sweatshop analogy comes out of there. Sure. When there was no attempt to restrict hours of work or to regulate working conditions. Now, is that a view you accept of that period?
Well, I think it's necessary to contrast it with what's happened in the interim. I don't see how we can talk about that without comparing it with the interim period. Now, you talked earlier about the fact that during the last 50 years, we had squandered some of our inheritance of freedom.
Absolutely.
And I believe during the last 50 years, we really have improved our freedom. I spent over half that time working for one of the world's largest industrial companies, the DuPont Company. Deeply involved with the launching of new ventures and got to know the free enterprise system well and have a very healthy respect for it. But during that interval, and particularly during the last few years, when I've been more involved with government and with environmental matters, I have become convinced that our freedom is improved when the people are allowed to add to their freedom in the marketplace, the freedom for voting with their dollars in the marketplace, the freedom to vote with their ballots in the polling place, to put some restraints on the excesses of the marketplace, particularly when you're concerned with such things as the long-term impact on our health from the pollution of our environment, the introduction of carcinogenic materials, or the irradiation of our people with nuclear products.
What about putting some restraints on the excesses of government? Hasn't that become an ever more serious problem? How is it that a government of the people, supposedly, does things which a very large fraction of the people would really prefer not to have done, such as overtax them, overgovern them, overregulate them? I think you're looking, again, at one side and not the other. And of course, I agree we have to look at what's happened in the interim. We're better off than we were 50 years ago. Never would deny that. But we stand on the shoulders of the people who went before. We have to look at how much they achieved from where they started. And that was a period in which you had the tremendous influx of immigrants from abroad, millions and millions and millions of them, when you opened up a new continent, when you had achievements.
Milton, are you saying, though, that there's any sense in which you'd rather go back to those circumstances where there are no regulations of factory work no hours, limitations of hour to work. Do you want to return to that, or do you just say that was a stepping stone to where we are now?
It depends on what you mean by circumstances. I don't want to have to go back to using a horse and buggy instead of an automobile. But I would prefer to go back to the kinds of governmental regulations or absence of regulations, the greater degree of freedom which was given to individuals to pursue one activity or another, which prevailed then, than which prevails now.
I think that really our industrial leaders have been dragged into the future screaming. They resisted the child labor laws, they resisted Social Security, labor unions, and now the environmental movement. Once the government forced them to pay attention to those by the voting of the people on the ballot box and in the polling place, then the industrial leaders, business leaders, paid attention to those rules and have done a good job in most cases of abiding by them.
Bob Galvin is an industrialist. Now, come on, is that a fair statement?
Maybe the industrialists have a clearer view of history and its prospects. The most precious asset we possess is freedom. The easiest way to lose one's freedom is to go into receivership, and I mean economic receivership, because a receiver is a dictator. And to the degree that we employ the costs and the burdens of government that lead us in the direction of further debt, ultimate receivership, and then the political consequence of the imposition of the political dictator over the economic and the job and the living rights of the individual, but maybe the industrialist can see farther down the pike as to the consequence of all this.
Michael Harrington?
I just think that two things. One, to view freedom positively, I think people over 65 years of age in the United States today are freer now because of Medicare. I do not think that the freedom to die from the lack of medicine was a very good thing. Secondly, related to industrialists, I think that one of the startling things about American history is that when Franklin Roosevelt was saving the system from itself, the main beneficiaries were screaming bloody murder at him for being a traitor to his class, when he was in fact the salvation of that class. And I think if you look at our history, I do think you find a tremendous myopia on the part of industrialists, and you find that the positive increments to our freedom, interestingly enough, have not come from the college graduates, but often from people with, not from the best people. It's come from working people. It's come from poor people. It's come from blacks and Hispanics and the like.
Milton, would you reply, but then tell us why you took us to Hong Kong to prove something.
Sure. Unaccustomed as I am to agreeing with Michael Harrington, I will agree in part with what he's just said. I do not believe it's proper to put the situation in terms of industrialists versus government. On the contrary, one of the reasons why I am in favor of less government is because when you have more government, industrialists take it over. And the two together form a coalition against the ordinary worker and the ordinary consumer. I think business is a wonderful institution, provided it has to face competition in the marketplace, and it can get away with something except by producing a better product at a lower cost. And that's why I don't want government to step in and help the business community. Now, I want to go to your question about Medicare. There are many people who have benefited from Medicare, but you're not looking at the cost side. What has happened to the people who are paying for it? We don't have a free good. It isn't coming from nowhere. And are they benefiting from it in a cost-effective way? Those are the questions. It's demagoguery, if you'll pardon me, Michael Harrington, to say the people who have Medicare are freer. Of course, in one dimension. But they themselves have been paying all their lives. And have they gotten a good bargain? At the moment, they have. The young men, the young working people who are going into Social Security now, they're going to get a very raw deal indeed.
Milton, interestingly, on that point, people over 65 are paying more of their spendable income for medical care now than they were before Medicare was enacted. It's been not a very successful program.
Government doesn't do things well. It doesn't do things well, so it hasn't done things well in Britain, in Canada, in the United States.
Now, Milton, then you took us to Hong Kong on exactly that point. That here, you said, was a true model of the market operating. Now, is that really a fair description of Hong Kong?
At the moment, yes. It's not again, there aren't any such things as 100% one way and 100% the other. Everything is mixed, of course. Hong Kong has a government. It happens to be a government. In this case, there's no democracy in Hong Kong. It's run from Britain. It's a crown colony of Britain. And the British Governor General and so on, the Financial Secretary, run it. But the situation in Hong Kong is that there is very little government regulation of industry. There's complete free trade. There are no tariffs. There are no export subsidies. There are no restrictions on the purchase and sale of monies. So that it comes about as close as to a complete free market as you can find in the world today. And there is no doubt that the main beneficiaries have been the low-income people, the poor people who poured into Hong Kong by the hundreds of thousands and millions out of Red China and who keep on trying to get in there. This goes to Michael Harrington's question. If an industrial system, if a free enterprise system is a system in which the poor are ground beneath the heels of these rapacious industrialists he's worried about, how would he explain the success in Hong Kong, the extent to which people continue to vote with their feet to go there?
You're not asking us to make of the United States one gigantic Hong Kong or sweatshop or whatever you want to call it. You'd acknowledge that there is a historical development of an economy, and what may be right for one stage in the development of an economy may not be right for another stage. Isn't the issue, where do we go from here? What pragmatic decisions do we make about the direction of the American economy? Should it be toward more and more government, or should it be trying to preserve an adequate balance between freedom of choice and government intervention?
Again, the problem is to distinguish two things. This comes back to an earlier comment, the circumstances in terms of the physical arrangements and the circumstances in terms of the rules that guide the society. Now, in the case of Hong Kong, of course, I'm not asking that we crowd our people to a density of population such as Hong Kong, as Hong Kong is a marvelous example just because its circumstances are so terrible, its physical circumstances. And the people in Hong Kong would love to get elsewhere into less crowded circumstances if other people would let them in. This is a problem of immigration, which is a very important restriction on human freedom. In the period before 1913, we had complete 100% freedom of immigration into the United States. We don't know. But go back to your question.
Do you think Hong Kong would exist if it weren't in close juxtaposition to communist China?
Hong Kong would exist. It is very dubious that it would have the policies it has now if it weren't in close juxtaposition to communist China. Well, now, but to answer your question directly, yes, I am in favor of the United States having not the circumstances, not the physical circumstances, but the policies that Hong Kong has had of zero tariffs, of complete free trade, of no restrictions on exports, no restrictions on monetary transactions, of a far greater degree of government, a far lesser degree of governmental regulation. I agree with what Russell Peterson said before, that there are third-party effects. There are things like pollution. The question is whether we're handling them in the right way, and I think we're not.
I want to bring Bob Galvin in here. You got the beginning of Milton's agenda there. No tariffs, for example, no restrictions, no quotas. Now, will business, big business, wear that kind of policy?
I think big business and all business could wear that kind of policy if we could find the appropriate balancing factor that in the rest of world trade, where we trade outside our border, and as others come in, we are required to trade against socialized institutions. That's a very different kind of an institution than the private institution. The private institution can clearly operate more efficiently if it is not imposed upon by an artificial price from the socialized institution across the seas. So I think there has to be not protectionism, but there has to be an international rule of the road that prevents the socialized institution from subsidizing and taking advantage of the private institution.
Did you include the 9 countries of the common market, though, as socialist countries? Or are you prepared to have open competition from all the 9 countries of the common market?
The 9 countries of the European common market engage in the most dramatic of the socialized institutions.
I don't agree with him at all. We are hurting ourselves by restricting trade from abroad. Other countries are hurting themselves and us by the measures you describe. But we're only hurting ourselves even the more if we imitate them.
I don't think, Dr. Friedman, that your mother would get a job sewing today in America if we had no tariffs at all. What would happen is there wouldn't be any sewing jobs in America. Well, we'd be making nothing but computers.
But then there would be some other kinds of jobs. Oh, and she would get a job at a very low level in making computers.
Yeah, although you do face the problem that you've had both a leading businessman and a leading conservative congressman not accepting your prescription of sweeping away restrictions.
But of course, the two greatest enemies of, the greatest enemies of free enterprise and of freedom in the world have been, on the one hand, the industrialists, and on the other hand, most of my academic colleagues who end up in government. For opposite reasons. People like Michael Harrington and my academic colleagues want freedom for themselves. They want free speech, they want freedom to write, they want freedom to publish, to do research, but they don't want freedom for any of those awful businessmen. Now, the businessmen are very different. Every businessman wants freedom for somebody else. But he wants special privilege for himself. He wants a tariff from Congress and the congressman. Well, the way in which congressmen get elected is by performing favors to constituents. And if indeed you were to wipe out completely all tariffs, if you were to reduce government controls in this country to what they are now, I do not think that would be in the self-interest of Barbara Conable, for whom I have the very greatest respect, or Bob Galvin, for whom I have the respect. I think it would be in the self-interest of Michael Harrington.
Now, let's ask what the American people want and will wear, because you're saying, in effect, that to get elected, the congressman is giving the people what they want. Now, aren't you saying in the end, then, the people don't want this or don't understand the advantage of it?
I'm saying that my whole function and purpose is to try to persuade the people to make a different thing politically profitable. I'm trying to persuade the people to make it clear that congressmen who pursue these policies are going to lose their jobs. And if we do that, congressmen are pursuing their self-interest. They're in a market. There's a political market. They've got a product to sell, and they've got to appeal to their customers. And I am just engaging in the kind of advertising Mr. Galvin and other companies
engage in. A very experienced politician, Governor Peterson.
Let me ask you how you would cope with this problem, Dr. Freeman. The people decided that they wanted cool air. There was a tremendous need. And so we built a huge industry, the air conditioner industry. Hundreds of thousands of jobs, tremendous earnings opportunities, and nearly all of us now have air-conditioned homes and cars and offices. But then the people decided they wanted clean air. And they couldn't buy it in the marketplace. So they voted at the polling place. They got their elected representatives to go to the Congress and say, we are going to have clean air. Now, overnight, there was a new market. And the free enterprise system responded to that. Now there's a big environmental industry making earnings, providing jobs, but also serving this public need to have the freedom to breathe clean air.
You grossly underestimate the extent to which the private market is able to do it. It's not an accident that the air, before you had any of this legislation, air and water were cleaner in the United States today than they were in the United States 100 years ago. You know, the automobile added one kind of pollution, but it eliminated a far worse kind of pollution. If you consider what the streets of New York would look like today if you were still transporting people by horse-drawn vehicles, you would have pollution on a scale that would stagger you. In the same way, it's not an accident that the air is cleaner and the water purer in those countries today that are the most advanced than they are in the backward country. It's not in Afghanistan that you find clean air and water. It's in the advanced countries. So the market is a very much more subtle mechanism than people give it credit for being.
I would like to get this back to the real world, because in the real world, there is no possibility that American business, which is a welfare-dependent business system, is going to adopt these ideas. What these ideas function as in the real world is a rationalization for the myth of free enterprise, which disguises the fact of state capitalism, as an argument against social intervention in a society that does intervene on behalf of the steel industry very quickly. Finally, in terms of the American political process, I don't believe that the political process is so simple as having the people elect the government. The fact is that when a Jimmy Carter is elected president on a relatively liberal platform, he then has to win business confidence because of the control of the investment process by corporate power. And I think that fact, corporate power, rationalized by free enterprise myths, is the central problem of freedom in our time, and that's what has to be attacked.
Before we come to Milton again...
I've got to comment on this, because I think we mustn't let words get in the way of what really is the case. I take it you think we don't have socialism. I would say to you that 46% of every corporation in this country is owned by the U.S. government. That's the corporate income tax. That means out of every dollar of profits that a corporation makes, 46 cents goes to the U.S. government. The actual tax is far higher than that because you tax that doubly when it comes to the individual. The extent to which corporations control their investment decisions has been increasingly reduced. The government is dictating what they spend their investment funds on in the name of pollution control and in the name of other things. It's a myth to suppose that there is some kind of a big corporate power over here. There was a time when corporations were more influential than they are now, but at the moment, I think they're a beleaguered minority rather than the dominant majority.
Well, I'd like to take the others into this for a moment. What is the process for those of you who want to roll back the state or to push back governmental influence on the operation of the economy? Before we let Milton in on that, what would you do as an active politician, as another politician, and a businessman?
Well, I personally think we ought to restrain the growth of government in the future.
How?
By putting some sort of limit on government expenditures. I would like to see a constitutional amendment doing that. Otherwise, we're going to continue to have the government growing faster than the economy and thus pushing more and more of the gross national product through the tin horn of government. I think that's a mistake. It's a difficult thing to do. I hope we can find some way to do it without making ourselves less free in some way.
Governor Peterson, can it be done?
Yes, I think we can make substantial headway by furthering our pluralistic society, by encouraging, educating more people to think comprehensively. I think one of the big problems in our world is that leaders in government and in industry are short-sighted. They don't look at the long-term impacts of their decisions. And in a democracy such as ours, the power is with the people, just like the textbooks say. And if they get this more comprehensive understanding and knowledge, they're going to see to it that the special interests of elected officials will be in tune with getting reelected, and they will look at the long-term views just like the citizenry is. So I'm all in favor of an all-out push to get this freedom to vote in the polling place added to the freedom of the marketplace, because that's a potent combination.
But voting in the polling place is a very different kind of freedom than voting in the marketplace. When you vote in the polling place, it is important, but it's a very different kind. When you vote for a package. And if you are in the minority, you lose. You don't get what you want. When you vote in the marketplace, everybody gets what he votes for. If I vote for a green tie, I get a green tie. You vote for a blue tie, you get a blue tie. If we do that in the polling booth, if 60% of us vote for a green tie, you have to wear a green tie.
Oh, but the 40% don't just shut up. They can try to influence the decision.
Of course, they can try to influence, but it's a very different and less efficient mechanism for matching performance, matching results to individual tastes and preferences.
Whatever kind of car I buy, I still get dirty air.
There are good people running this society, and most of the people that we're talking about work someplace, and they know that their company is doing something pretty good or trying to do something pretty good. I think the people are going to start telling the leaders where they've gone wrong and start to redress it by the direction of the ballot box.
Is it people in general are more conservative and in particular are more liberal? That is to say, if you ask the people in general, what do you think of government, get it off my back, less taxes. If you ask in particular, what about health, national health? What about full employment, government as the employer of last resort? What about pollution? Do something about it. Everett Ladd had an article in Fortune about a year ago, which is hardly a radical left-wing journal, showing this contradiction. And I think that there is in the United States today a rapid movement to the left, right, and center, which I obviously hope will be resolved not by an across-the-boards cut aimed primarily at poor and working people, but at by an increasing democratization of economic power and an increasing democratization of the government. I think that in this complicated society of huge institutions and bureaucracies, if we talk about freedom, one of the things I would like to see would be a law providing funds for any significant minority to buy the research to counter the majority. If you don't have the expertise, the knowledge technology today, you're out of the debate. And I think that we have to democratize information and government as well as the economy and society.
I am sorry to say Michael Harrington's solution is not a solution to it. He wants minority rule. I don't. I want individual rule. I want human beings separately and individually to have control of their lives. I don't believe that a minority that differs with me should have the right to take money out of my pocket to research for them. They should go out and try to persuade people to contribute to them. I should be free to get people to contribute to me to present my ideas. But the idea of having some kind of an official government agency that is going to finance dissidents in the first place, anybody who has any sense of realism about the way government operates at all will know that that'll end up in the hands of the majority and not the minority.
But can government, in this extremely interdependent, complex world economy which is developing, can you have a mystical belief in the invisible hand of Adam Smith? I happen to think that Adam Smith is one of the greatest intellectual figures in the history of the world, and that capitalism was one of the greatest advances that humankind has ever made. But precisely because I put this in historical context, capitalism, as a friend of mine by the name of Karl Marx predicted some time ago, has developed tremendous tendencies towards monopoly, concentration, multinational corporations, money supplies that that are not controlled by the Federal Reserve Bank or even the President of the United States anymore. And to think that you can respond to this radically new environment by an 18th century solution, I think really comes down to an intellectual exercise whose practical political effect is to rationalize conservative power in America.
This is a myth, a complete myth, that the development of an interdeveloped country in a more complicated world necessitates greater government intervention. Government intervention has not grown in those areas which arise out of the complexity and interdependence of the world. It's grown where? In taking money from some people and giving it to others.
All I have to say is that government, Dr. Friedman, has to live in the 20th century, much less the 19th or the 18th.
But again,
and we have to take society as it exists today and build on that.
To me, the decisive thing at issue here is an essentially mythic, non-historical presentation of an abstract solution taken out of time, which does not look to the tremendous evolution of capitalist society, the tremendous interdependence of the world, the fact that we now have not only national economic planning, but at the Tokyo summit, then we have institutionalized international economic planning of the major industrial capitalist powers. And under those circumstances, granted the enormous achievement of Adam Smith, granted the enormous achievement of capitalist society, under this radically changed historical situation to propose those classic old solutions, I think is to propose something non-serious, which, however, does function seriously to rationalize conservative corporate economic and political power.
The great achievements of the 19th century came from by departing from the kind of system you now want to reimpose. You want to take us back to the 18th and 17th century when we had a corporate society, when we had government controlling things. The whole issue is what somebody is proposing in the 20th and the 19th and the 18th. The whole issue is what is the right thing to do? What is the best way in which we can widen our opportunities, preserve our freedom, maintain our prosperity? And it seems to me the kind of solutions you would propose involve more of the same, more of the measures that have failed over and over again to achieve the objectives.
Well, we leave the debate for there this week, and we hope you'll join us again for the next edition of Free to Choose.
Want more episodes like this? Don't forget to subscribe and get updates each week for the Free to Choose Media Podcast.